Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Dave DeForest reporting. President Petro Poroshenko told Ukraine's parliament rockets today hit the government military headquarters in the Ukrainian city of Kramatorsk, as well as some residential areas. A presidential advisor wrote on Facebook that two servicemen were killed and nine were wounded at the headquarters. A local government official reported that seven civilians were killed and 16 wounded in residential areas. Earlier, pro-government forces reported making some gains. Meanwhile, representatives of Russia, Ukraine, Germany, and France are due to meet in the capital of Belarus on Wednesday to try to reach an agreement to end the 10-month conflict. The White House confirms that a U.S. woman held hostage by Islamic State militants in Syria is dead. The announcement comes 4 days after the Islamist group said aid worker Kayla Mueller was killed in a Jordanian airstrike on a building in Raqqa where she was being held. Syrian President Bashar al-Assad says his government receives information about U.S.-led airstrikes against Islamic State militants in Syria, but said there is no direct cooperation. Mr. Assad told the BBC in Damascus that there are exchanges of messages through third parties such as Iraq, but that they do not include tactical information. The president said Syria would not join the U.S.-led coalition. Witnesses say at least 12 people were killed and 30 wounded in central Somalia today when a moderate Islamist group fought with Somali government troops. The violence started when Alu Suna Valjama forces attacked government bases in the town of Guri El, about 400 kilometers north of Mogadishu. A witness says government troops were driven out of the town. This is VOA News. An anti-corruption party won a major local election victory in India's state capital, routing the party of Prime Minister Narendra Modi. The Election Commission of India said the Aam Aadmi Party won 56 seats and was leading in 11 other races for the 70-seat assembly in New Delhi. Sandhyam is a spokeswoman for the party.
And this is really a landslide victory which we expected to, but we did not want to preempt it. Now we are very happy that we have won this.
Mr. Modi's Bharatiya Janata Party won just 3 seats. It is the party's first setback since he became prime minister last year. Malaysia's highest court has upheld a sodomy conviction against Malaysian opposition leader Anwar Ibrahim. Ron Corbin reports.
Malaysia's news bulletins were led with the breaking news Tuesday that opposition leader Anwar Ibrahim had lost his fight to stay free after a federal court upheld an appeals court verdict over charges of sodomy. Federal court judge Arifin Zakat said there was overwhelming evidence that Anwar had in 2008 sodomized an aide, sending the 67-year-old politician to prison. Human rights and opposition groups criticised the verdict, calling it politically motivated and targeted to put an end to Anwar's long involvement in Malaysian politics. Ron Corbin for VOA News, Bangkok, Thailand.
The number of deaths from Ebola has risen to 9,152. That's a sharp increase following weeks in which the outbreak appeared to be weakening. The death toll reported today by the World Health Organization represents a jump of nearly 150 deaths since the agency's last update 3 days earlier. Suspected Boko Haram militants from Nigeria have killed some of the passengers they seized from a bus in Cameroon on Monday. A witness tells VOA kidnappers killed 7 of the 20 hostages and dumped their bodies on Cameroon's northern border with Nigeria. A local official says his brother, who was driving the bus, was found with one of his arms and one of his legs chopped off. He said the kidnappers freed 3 elderly women and are still holding 10 hostages, including 8 girls, ages 11 to 14. Russia's President Vladimir Putin is in Cairo on a 2-day official visit aimed at boosting his government's ties with Egypt. Mr. Putin was greeted at the Cairo International Airport Monday by Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi. The United Nations today said the Taliban's involvement in criminal activity appears to have increased in Afghanistan. A new study conducted by the UN Security Council Committee warns that the trend has consequences for peace and security in the country. Criminal behavior includes narcotics trafficking, illicit mining, collusion with organized crime, and kidnapping for ransom. I'm Dave DeForest in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
A new UN report finds Libya is beset by turmoil, lawlessness, and armed conflict. The report by the UN Human Rights Office and the UN Support Mission in Libya on the human rights situation in 2014 will be formally presented to the Human Rights Council in March.
That's Lisa Schlein reporting from the launch of the report in Geneva. Details coming up.
Also, a Cameroon school official reports that at least 8 girls have been kidnapped and 7 other people killed when gunmen attacked a bus on Sunday not far from the Nigerian border.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from the Horn of Africa, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, at least a dozen people were killed when a Sufi militia clashed with Somali troops in the town of Guri El, about 400 kilometers from Mogadishu. A doctor in the town tells VOA's Somali service that his health clinic is treating 30 who were wounded in the fighting. Another witness says that the ASWJ, or the Alu Sunawal Jama militia, attacked a government base in the town, driving the troops out. He says the Sufi force now controls the town. ASWJ militias joined other Somali forces in forcing al-Shabaab militants out of Mogadishu. Today's clash with government troops follows the Sufi group's request for greater representation in the Somali government. But the government insists ASWJ work within the clan structure and wants it integrated into the National Army.
A Cameroon school official reports that at least 8 girls have been kidnapped and 7 other people killed when gunmen attacked a bus on Sunday not far from the Nigerian border. Armed attacks are also being reported in nearby towns. The school principal says the girls are between the ages of 11 and 14 and are from the Cameroon town of Koza. Chitima Adamidu, the brother of the school bus driver, says security officials found the bodies of his brother and 6 passengers scattered near the border. The attack took place 18 kilometers inside Cameroon. Residents today say the attackers are from Boko Haram, the extremist group that has launched terrorist attacks on civilians and military in 3 northern Nigerian states for 5 years. More than 1.5 million Nigerians have been displaced in the north. The violence has recently spread to Cameroon, Chad, Niger, and Benin, where all governments are pledging to defeat Boko Haram. The continued violence also has forced Nigeria to delay its national presidential election for a month.
In October, Boko Haram militants seized Mubi, the commercial hub in Nigeria's northern Adamawa state. Mubi was the biggest town under the insurgents' control before the Nigerian military recaptured it in November. In those few weeks, the militants ruled by whim, conscripted by gunpoint, and imposed harsh punishments. Katerina Hoya talked with some Mubi residents who recalled what it was like to live under Boko Haram. She has this report from Lagos.
The head bodyguard for the mayor of Mubi, Abdullahi Umaru, could do nothing but watch as Boko Haram fighters stomped across his boss's polished floors and manhandled expensive furniture before they settled in the ruler's private quarters. They then proceeded to the mayor's private fleet of cars to take their pick. They only choose the best cars, Umaru says. That was late October when Boko Haram seized Mubi, raised the black flag and promptly renamed the town Madinatul Islam, City of Islam. Taking control of the second largest town in Adamawa State was part of the terrorist group's quest to establish a caliphate in northern Nigeria. Soon after, the group banned drinking and smoking and carried out lashings and amputations on people accused of stealing, says Issa Barade, the emir's head servant. The militants themselves, however, were not very good Muslims, he says, noting the Boko Haram fighters looted shops and occupied private homes. Barde says the militants did make a limited effort to win the hearts of the townspeople, occasionally handing out some stolen food and goods. They used to tell us not to be afraid, that they were fighting the military, not the population, he says. Bukaram effectively cut the town off from the world. In the market, basic goods like pasta, rice and flour became scarce. They cut mobile phone service and used satellite phones to run operations. Some of the residents say the fighters observed a clear command structure but lacked discipline. It was clear there were local recruits who just joined because the militants pay them, Umaru says. The fighters also took children to a nearby field for military and weapons training. For the women of Mubi, life under Boko Haram was especially difficult. As a woman, you could still move in the streets, but you had to make sure to not look at the fighters, says Sarawu Amadu. The penalty for looking at a Boko Haram militant was 70 lashes. To constantly worry for your husband and children made many women go crazy, she says. And then there were the forced marriages. If the insurgents saw a girl they liked, they would approach the parents, offering them between $50 and $100. Girls 15 years and older were considered eligible. She says the parents had been told by the emir not to resist the fight back, so they would agree to the fighters' offers and then try to send the daughters away before the marriage could take place. When the insurgents understood the Nigerian army was coming, they left Mubi in a hurry. While Mubi is liberated, Boko Haram still controls a large territory in the northeast. The threat they pose has forced a six-week delay in national elections to let a new regional force carry out a military operation to give towns and villages here enough security to vote. But after years of fighting, thousands killed and about 1 million displaced, many Nigerians are asking, what difference will a few more weeks make? This is Katrina Høie for VA News in Lagos.
A new UN report finds Libya is beset by turmoil, lawlessness and armed conflict. The report by the UN Human Rights Office and the UN Support Mission in Libya will be formally presented to the Human Rights Council in March. Lisa Schlein reports from the launch of the report in Geneva.
The report dashes any lingering hope the Arab Spring would result in Libya's becoming a democratic, egalitarian nation. It paints a bleak picture of a society run by several armed factions determined to exert their power not by rule of law, but of the gun. Report authors say Libya is facing the worst political crisis and escalation of violence since the 2011 armed conflict that toppled long-reigning dictator Muammar Gaddafi. Human rights spokesman Rupert Colville says civilians last year were victims of indiscriminate artillery and air attacks. He says unlawful killings and summary executions, including targeted assassinations, were commonplace.
Footage appearing to show a number of beheadings in Benghazi and Derna emerged in November, and a number of hospitals, schools, as well as airports and other public infrastructure were attacked and damaged or used for military purposes. Children have suffered tremendously, with large numbers unable to go to school in their hometowns, and some killed or maimed at home or during attacks on schools and hospitals.
The report documents a wide range of gross violations of human rights committed by all armed factions. These include harassment, intimidation, torture, abductions, and summary executions. It notes human rights defenders, journalists, members of the judiciary, and politicians are among those specifically targeted for abuse. The UN report describes numerous incidents of violence against women, minority groups, and Egyptian Coptic Christians during the past year. It highlights the extremely vulnerable situation of migrants and internally displaced people in Libya. It says thousands of people are in detention, with many subject to torture or other ill treatment. Two competing parliaments and governments claim legitimacy and the right to rule Libya. In reality, the report notes powerful armed groups exercise effective control, committing human rights violations with impunity. UN-sponsored peace talks are underway. Colville tells VOA he hopes for the best, but is unable to rate their chances of success.
The political dialogue is the only game in town, and it's really vital. Some way of finding a way through this, real turmoil, and the country's in great, great danger.
A stark reflection of the gravity of the crisis facing Libya can be seen in the numbers. The UN Monitoring Mission reports the number of internally displaced has soared from an estimated 60,000 at the beginning of 2014 to 400,000 by mid-November. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
In related news, the European Union is threatening to freeze assets and ban travel of Libyans, undermining UN-brokered peace talks. Foreign ministers voted yesterday in an effort to support flagging efforts of the UN envoy to Libya to end the fighting. A small group of former members of Libya's Congress and militias that now controls the capital Tripoli has boycotted previous peace talks.
Minutes past the hour. This is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. An organization providing medical assistance to Ebola-affected countries is expanding its operations to include other health needs. Direct Relief is taking the action as fewer new Ebola cases are reported. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
From the early days of the West Africa Ebola outbreak, Direct Relief has been sending emergency medical supplies to the region. So far, it's sent 40 shipments of medical aid worth $25 million. The organization gets its supplies directly from pharmaceutical companies for use in poor countries. Andrew McCullough is Direct Relief's Director of International Programs and Emergency Response.
Direct Relief has been one of the largest, if not the largest, and one of the earliest providers of medical assistance into West Africa since the outbreak came about.
Direct Relief has delivered most of the supplies to Liberia and Sierra Leone, where they were distributed to about 1,000 hospitals and clinics. The organization works with the governments as well as many NGOs in the affected countries.
The first plane load was mostly the basic personal protective gear for folks treating Ebola patients. And then as it's dwindling a bit over there, we're now kind of shifting our focus more towards the essential healthcare commodities, the essential medications for just restoring the health system that's been so devastated by Ebola.
There had been many calls prior to the Ebola outbreak to upgrade healthcare systems in Africa. In most places, it did not happen. The epidemic showed just how fragile the health systems were.
As we know, this was an area that already had some major struggles in its health delivery system after coming off civil wars and very low doctor-to-patient ratios and extremely high maternal mortality rates. So when Ebola came about and came to be such a big issue, so much of the already lacking health supplies and doctors were diverted towards Ebola. So then what you had was normal, everyday medical things became a much lower priority.
McCullough says there have been higher rates of malaria and tuberculosis, as well as other health concerns.
We're keeping an eye on the Ebola outbreak and know that it needs to get to zero, but really wanting to focus back on things that have been almost forgotten about. The moms that are pregnant that need to deliver babies safely with a skilled birth attendant. So we're providing 250 midwife kits for midwives around the country.
He says there's still a shortage of basic medical supplies.
In this most recent plane that just landed last week, we sent things specifically requested by the Ministries of Health and the CDC to go into medical clinics in Liberia and Sierra Leone to essentially just be able to reopen them. They've had such a drain out of basic supplies like gloves and masks and gowns and bleach and basic medications that we prepackaged 100 facility kits, about 50 tons of stuff, to essentially reopen 100 clinics.
McCullough says the goal is to support the people who live and work in Liberia and Sierra Leone.
We're committed there. The Ministries of Health have asked us to remain there, and we will do so. We're there for the long run.
The direct relief official says Liberia and Sierra Leone can be rebuilt after the Ebola crisis. He says it will take focus, funding, awareness, medical training, and upgraded health facilities. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
The UNHCR is appealing to the European Union for increased search and rescue capacity in the Mediterranean. They say yesterday's tragedy at sea left 29 people dead, the first major loss of life reported this year off the coast of Lampedusa. UNHCR says it is saddened and concerned about the manner of the deaths. It appears all but seven of the 29 deaths were caused by hypothermia while on board a rescue vessel. I spoke with Carlotta Sammy, UNHCR spokesperson in Rome, about the incident and about what needs to be done to avoid such tragedies.
This is the first major tragedy that happened in the Mediterranean this year, in 2015. At least 29 people have died, and so many of them have died of hypothermia. They have died once they have been rescued on the vessels of the Coast Guard. They were in deep sea, 100 miles south of the island, the little island of Lampedusa.
I understand that 106 people that were on that vessel did survive. And where are they now?
They are on the first reception center in Lampedusa. And those that were in need of medical attention, they have been transferred to hospital.
Where were they coming from?
They left most probably from Libya, of course. And all of them, they are from sub-Saharan African origin.
Of course, it was good that 106 lives were saved. But looking at the overall picture of search and rescue efforts, what more needs to be done in this area?
We certainly applaud the rescue efforts in this case because we know that the Italian Coast Guard was out at deep sea for almost 24 hours in very rough conditions. But this incident is a strong reminder of when the two big tragedies happened off to Lampedusa in 2013, where more than 600 people have died. Why at that time everybody was saying that a big search and rescue operation was needed in the Mediterranean to cope with the scale of the influx of migrants and refugees. Now, the Italian government put an operation in place in 2014 that managed to rescue more than 160,000 people. But now this operation is off, and we have a new operation that is carried out by the European Union called Triton. But Triton, we think at UNHCR, is not enough. It means an operational capacity are too low, too weak.
So then if this is not enough, then what more can be done at this time, especially since more and more people are attempting this risky journey?
Yes, exactly, because already the first months of 2015, we had more people crossing the Mediterranean than the same period in 2014. So what is needed is to increase the operational capacity with big ships and a continuous patrolling of international waters, while the Triton operation is patrolling only the 30 miles maritime borders of the European Union and intervening just when the case is desperate, while the previous operation was continuously monitoring the sea and was able not only to rescue continuously migrants and refugees, but also to arrest many smugglers.
Now, of course, Italy is dealing with a huge influx of migrants coming in there. So how are they able to cope with this situation?
The situation is one in which a strong contingency plan is needed because we faced some improvement in 2014 in the capacity of Italy to receive migrants in the front line, you know, but we are seeing already signals that this trend of an increasing influx will continue. So the Italian government need to put in place a contingency plan to strengthen what started in 2014. For sure, what we say is that the Frontex operation, Triton operation, the European Asylum Support kind of helped to Italy and other southern EU countries, but they cannot be the only form of solidarity. These are not humanitarian operations, considering the increasing crisis in the Middle East in particular. What is needed is a strong humanitarian operation to boost search and rescue in the Mediterranean.
That was Carlotta Sammy, a spokesperson for the UNHCR. She spoke with me from Rome.
It has been more than 40 years since the discovery in Ethiopia of the early human skeleton named Lucy. She's one of the most famous finds of the 20th century. Lucy helped researchers better understand the history of humans. The man who found Lucy spoke to VOA correspondent Elizabeth Lee during his visit to the Natural History Museum of Los Angeles County.
What visitors find at a natural history museum may seem far removed from the present day, but the man who discovered the famous Lucy skeleton, Don Johansson, says these old bones carry a profound message across the ages.
There is a single common origin for humanity. No matter the shape of our eyes, no matter the color of our skin, no matter the shape of our hair, no matter what kind of culture we live in, we all carry those same genes in our body. We are united by our past. We're united by this common beginning.
It is an idea made even more important given that humans come from Africa, which wasn't understood clearly just 40 years ago.
Through much of the 20th century, there was this very Eurocentric view that we all evolved in Europe, that was the finishing school for humanity. But now there's almost complete consensus among scholars who study human origins that Africa was the place, just as Darwin had predicted way back in the middle 1800s.
Up until around the time Lucy's skeleton was discovered in Ethiopia, the year was 1974. At 3.2 million years old, she was the oldest human ancestor found at the time. But beyond a message of commonality, Lucy also welcomed us into a broader family of primates.
Lucy, while she was found so many years ago, still remains terribly important for understanding our earliest beginnings and occupies a very important place on the human family tree as a bridge between more ape-like and more human-like creatures.
Johansson says Lucy was just over a meter tall, with an ape-like face and a small brain. She had long arms and short legs, but she also possessed an important human feature, the ability to walk upright. But you can see glimmers of humanity in Lucy. Scientists recently discovered that Australopithecus used crude stone tools. That's something that our ape and chimpanzee cousins can do, but which is still uncommon in the natural world. As the saying goes, we've come a long way. Elizabeth Lee for VOA News, Los Angeles.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butter here to remind you that February is Black History Month in the United States. And starting February 2nd, we'll begin our Black History Month series and daily quiz on Daybreak Africa. Listen every morning as we profile historical African-American and African individuals and events. You can win special VOA goodies by answering one of our daily Black History questions. Please send your answers to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. You can also call us on 202-205-9942. That's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your answer. We will select a winner each morning from among the correct answers.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. At least a dozen people were killed when a Sufi militia clashed with Somali troops in the town of Guri El. A Cameroon school official reports that at least 8 girls have been kidnapped and 7 other people killed when gunmen attacked a bus on Sunday not far from the Nigerian border. And a new report finds Libya is beset with turmoil, lawlessness, and armed conflict. Coming up, we'll have music from the Horn of Africa, and in our feature segment, as part of Black History Month, recognizing the history and achievements of African Americans. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehia Swuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is African News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Well, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Happy Tuesday, Sunny.
Happy Tuesday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you have a look back at the recent Africa Cup of Nations football tournament.
Kim, joining us once again for that Nations Cup look back is our African football guru, David Legg. Good evening, David.
Good evening, Sunny.
David, the 30th Africa Cup of Nations football tournament is now history. Ivory Coast wins its second trophy. Bit of deja vu in Bata. The Ivorians prevailing by another long penalty kick shootout, just as they did in 1992 when they also beat Ghana. Your thoughts on the final, David?
It was almost like an action replay of 1992. Ivory Coast and Ghana, no goals after 120 minutes. In 1992, Sunny, they needed 24 penalties to settle the issue. And this time they needed 22. And how ironic that at the end of the day, it was right down to the two goalkeepers. I mean, the last people you would expect to be scoring goals. Ivory Coast started a penalty shootout very badly. They had their first shot against the woodwork and the second wide. So Ghana had an early 2-0 lead. But then they failed to convert the next two penalties. Ivory Coast scored from both. So now it was 2-2. And then the drama really unfolded, Sonny, with both sides converting under a lot of pressure and doing very well. And then it crept up to 8 penalties each from 10 kicks. And then it was the turn of the two goalkeepers. And what Boubacar Barry did was he saved from Brema. He then dusted himself down, went to the penalty spot, and slotted the ball past Brema for the winning penalty. And it was quite ironic, Sonny, that it should be Boubacar Barry, because he, for many years now, and I've certainly been among those, has been under severe criticism. He has been seen as the real weak link in this Ivorian elephants lineup. I think our views were borne out by the fact that during this tournament, it was actually Sylvain Gbaou who took over as the number one goalkeeper, but he was injured in the semi-final victory over the DR Congo. In comes Barry. He doesn't concede a goal during 120 minutes, and then he converts the decisive penalty, so a real fairy tale for him. Looking at the comments he made afterwards, he seems to be a very humble person. He dedicated the victory, not to himself or not even to the present team, but he said it's to the stars of the previous teams that had built the foundations.
Hi, Didier Drogba, striker from Ivory Coast.
Sad in a way, Sonny, that Didier Drogba missed out because he retired from international football. But some of the so-called golden generation did finally get those winners' medals, and they include the Touré brothers, Kolo and Yaya. Also, Sonny, a great final for Hervé Renard. He becomes the first coach ever in Cup of Nations history to win the title with two different countries. In 2012, it was Zambia, ironically against the Ivory Coast, and also, I guess, ironically, after yet another penalty shootout. Now, Hassan Shahata of Egypt and Charles Gamfi of Ghana, they have won three titles as opposed to the two of Reynard. But in the case of Shahata, it was always Egypt, and in the case of Gamfi, it was always Ghana. So congratulations to Hervé Renard, who I must say is not only very popular with Ivorian football supporters, but certainly here in South Africa, Sonny, the females They just love this coach very, very much.
I think maybe it has something to do with him dancing shirtless, David, after the match.
Oh, I would never suggest something like that, Sonny. You know, I was just concentrating on the football. He's a very media-savvy man. You saw those shots of him during the penalty shootout. He's very conscious of when he's on camera. But congratulations to Renard. He reminds me a lot of Philippe Truthier, the white witch doctor who came to Africa a couple of decades ago, also a Frenchman, although Truthier perhaps with a slightly shorter temper than Renard. Renard seems to be a very patient man. And let's give credit to Renard, too, because he didn't start off well, Sonny. If we go back to late last year to the qualifiers, Ivory Coast suffered a couple of humiliating losses. I'm thinking particularly of that 4-1 defeat in Yaoundé against Cameroon. And then, perhaps even more shocking, a 4-3 defeat in Abidjan, the great fortress of Ivorian football, against the Democratic Republic of Congo. It's been a long, long time since Ivory Coast have conceded 4 goals in any game, never mind in 2 games within the 1 qualifying competition. But Renard kept us cool. He also had a tough start in the Equatorial Guinea Group D, held 1-1 by both Mali and Guinea. And then came what he said after the final was a crucial victory over Cameroon by 1-0. He felt that was a good Cameroon side, and he felt that by beating them, he believed that Ivory Coast could go all the way. Then if we go forward slightly, Sonny, to the quarterfinals, in many ways to me, this was the final before the final, when they beat Algeria 3-1. The Algerians certainly had their chances in that game. They could have beaten the Ivorians, and Renard later said that, in fact, Algeria were the better team on the day. But goals by Wilfred Bonny, 2 of them from headers, made all the difference. The Ivorians were clearly too good for the DR Congo in the semi-final. And then in the final itself, Sonny, which was not, from a neutral fan's perspective, particularly exciting game, the Ivorians took me that priority number 1 was not to lose, and it seemed almost to be the same with the Ghanaians. But the Ghanaians can feel hard done by that they didn't win after 90 minutes because twice they were denied by the woodwork. A great strike by Atsu midway through the first half swerved past Barry and came back off the post. And then later in the first half, from a very tight angle, Andre Ayew also struck the woodwork with Barry beaten. And that's also sad for their recently appointed coach, Avram Grant, because he, in 2008, was the manager of Chelsea, and they played Manchester United in the UEFA Champions League final in Moscow, 1-1 after extra time, penalties, and Chelsea lost. So for the next few days, Sonny, don't mention the words penalty shootout to Avram Grant.
David, you mentioned Ivory Coast beating DR Congo in the semifinals. The Leopards from the DRC salvaged some pride by winning the third-place match over host Equatorial Guinea. How about a look back at that game?
Yeah, not an awful lot to remember from that one, Sonny. 0-0 and then 4-2 on penalties for the DR Congo. But interestingly, the first time we've had a third-place match without any goals, and that's going way back to 1962. Not a particularly good game, but I suppose, Sonny, from a news perspective, the big issue was the fact that it was trouble-free because it was held in the same Malabo Stadium where 48 hours before you had this rioting and 36 people injured, 14 of them requiring hospital treatment after the semi-final between Ghana and Equatorial Guinea. I have noticed with a great deal of anger, the CAF president, Issa Hayatou, has lashed out at the Western media, basically accusing them of fabricating the situation. Now, it's all very well for Mr. Hayatou. He's up there in the VIP area, well protected from, among other objects, Sonny, and I've seen the photographs, so it's a fact, a jagged piece of a half-broken mirror. Also, a plate that was broken. And if you're hit by a flying plate, you can get killed. It's as simple as that. There were also flying broken chairs, etc., etc. It was no fun in that stadium, particularly if you were a supporter of Ghana. At the time, the Ghana Football Association, the GFA, they made several tweets, and in one of them they specifically said that it is like a war zone. That's what they described the stadium as, a war zone. And that's a pretty strong word coming from any football official. And then they talked about barbaric acts of violence. But then amazingly, 24 hours later, the same Ghanaian official, he was lauding the fact that Issa Hayatou had played such a wonderful role in the staging of the 2015 Cup of Nations at short notice in Equatorial Guinea after Morocco pulled out because of fears over the Ebola epidemic. The likes of Mr. Hayatou, they might feel very good for themselves and the fact that they're lashing out at the media. But I think, Sonny, all of us, whether we were actually there in the stadium or watching it on TV or perhaps listening to radio, Voice of America, realized exactly what happened. And for those 36 people who were injured, I don't think they for one second believed that the media were exaggerating anything. It was a very ugly, dangerous situation. I've looked, Sonny, at the media coverage, both from Africa and from the West, meaning Europe, which seems to be a particular concern of President Hayatou. And I didn't see any exaggeration. What I saw, actually, was basically factual reporting of a very ugly situation and one that sadly marred what in many ways was a very successful and good tournament.
Thanks, David. That's our African football guru, David Legg, speaking with us once again from Johannesburg, South Africa. They're playing back. In National Basketball Association action Monday night, the Golden State Warriors improved the league's best record with an 89-84 road victory over the Philadelphia 76ers. The Warriors now have a record of 41 wins and 9 losses. Guard Stephon Curry, who will start for the Western Conference in Sunday's annual NBA All-Star Game, led the Warriors with 20 points. Elsewhere, the Atlanta Hawks defeated the host Minnesota Timberwolves 117-105. Atlanta is right behind Golden State in the overall league standings with 43 victories and 10 defeats. Al Horford, who also will play in Sunday's All-Star game, led the Hawks with 28 points. And let's give quick Sunny Side of Sports shout-outs for two other Atlanta players, Paul Millsap and Jeff Teague, who also were selected for the All-Star game. Meanwhile, perennial All-Star Kevin Durant poured in a game-high 40 points Monday night to lead the Oklahoma City Thunder to a 124-114 victory over the Denver Nuggets. In other results, my beloved Washington Wizards waved their wands once again and beat the visiting Orlando Magic 96-80. The Miami Heat beat the New York Knicks 109-95. The Los Angeles Clippers topped the Dallas Mavericks 115-98. The Utah Jazz edged the New Orleans Pelicans 100-96. The Milwaukee Bucks beat the Brooklyn Nets 103-97. And the defending NBA champion San Antonio Spurs, playing on the road, edged the Indiana Pacers 95-93. Now, Sunday's NBA All-Star Game will be played at Madison Square Garden in New York City, the home arena of the New York Knicks Club. The Knicks have the worst record in the NBA with 10 wins and 42 losses. But one happy note, Knicks veteran forward Carmelo Anthony was voted by the fans to start in Sunday's NBA All-Star Game. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Yahaeus Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny, and listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, recognizing the history and achievements of African Americans. And next, establishing hundreds of community schools in various parts of South Sudan. But first, some music from the Horn of Africa. Here is Miriam Chemos with Africa Rising.
To order, as just defined, they won't take us under. One right can't taste upon the Bible. Guess the jury know about survival. We beat the firing squad with no rifles. But would you mind, this war is mental. Oh, to a new way, Africa. To a message, to hide away. To a no way, Ubanguzi. Wakapila, now I can leave. To Heshimo, Africa. To Kabuke, history away.
From the Horn of Africa, Miriam Chemos with Africa Rising.
Well, 50 years ago, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. fought for racial equality in the southern United States. The landscape of the region was drastically different then. African Americans were denied basic human rights and freedoms under local and state laws designed to keep blacks and whites separated. From the southern U.S. city of Birmingham, Alabama, VOA's Chris Simpkins gives us a snapshot of what many African Americans endured in a segregated South.
Birmingham was known as the most segregated city in the South. An example was here at the Lyric Theater. White customers could enter the theater through the front door, while black customers had to go around the corner to a back alley to enter through an entrance marked colored only. Many southern communities passed laws to separate blacks and whites in schools, restaurants, and many other public places. Congressman John Lewis, who grew up in rural Alabama, says he tasted the bitter fruits of racism.
I didn't like it. I saw those signs that said white men, white women, white waiting, colored waiting.
Civil rights activist Hollis Watkins from Mississippi remembers some of the unwritten rules.
That if you are walking down the sidewalk and you meet white people, you step off the side and bow your head until they pass. Because if you didn't, it could be considered disrespectful and they might kick you, beat you, or put you in jail.
Among many white Southerners, there was a fierce resistance to changing the way of life in the South. In June 1963, Alabama Governor George Wallace blocked two African Americans from enrolling at the all-white University of Alabama. After federal marshals and the National Guard stepped in, Wallace stepped aside. For his daughter Peggy, it was a painful memory.
It stained Alabama, of course, but it stained him for the rest of his life.
The symbols of racial segregation in the South started disappearing after the passage of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, giving millions of African Americans the same freedom and liberties enjoyed by the country's then predominantly white population. Chris Simpkins, VOA News, Birmingham, Alabama.
South Sudan schools received a $7 million boost when the BRAC International, a non-governmental organization in The Hague, Netherlands, announced it will establish schools for more than 10,000 students in four states. The U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, will partner with BRAC. Local education officials welcome the support for thousands of students whose education has been disrupted by the ongoing conflict. Mugume Davis Rowakaringi has this report from Juba.
USAID says the new project will provide basic but quality education for 10,500 young children and adolescents now unable to attend school in Eastern Equatoria, Western Equatoria, Central Equatoria, and Lake States. The funding is expected to support schooling for a period of 3 years. The project will be implemented by BRAC International, which focuses on long-term poverty reduction strategies. Organizers want 60% of the program's beneficiaries to be females, who are far less likely to receive education in South Sudan for reasons which extend beyond conflict and insecurity. Speaking at the launch of the project, Charles Twining, the acting United States ambassador to South Sudan, said girls' education is fundamental for national development.
I believe all here today agree the emphasis on getting more girls into schools is critical. No country that neglects the education and development of half of its population can hope to advance and compete in the global market. We do need to remember the important role that both men and women do play in rebuilding the nation. And as we all know, South Sudan very much needs such rebuilding.
Education Minister John Gayo agrees.
Community girls' education has provided employment opportunity to our people. And this is something we have to appreciate. Also, targeting 70% of our young girls who cannot, for various reasons, go to normal primary education means that the gap we are filling in is a big gap.
The project does not just focus on students. 350 South Sudanese teachers will benefit by way of improved salaries and more training. Gayo says his ministry is working with educational partners to ensure that South Sudan has achieved universal primary education for all boys and girls by the year 2025. According to Ministry of Education, just 27% of South Sudanese citizens aged 15 and older are able to read and write, and there are major educational disparities between girls and boys. Whereas the literacy rate for boys stands at 40%, it is only 16% for girls. Cultural practices also play a bigger role in preventing girls from attending school. Early marriage ends education for many, and prioritizing advanced education for sons leaves many daughters consigned to agricultural work or manual labor. But through the BRAC International Project, officials hope to illustrate the benefits of fueling the minds and goals of South Sudanese girls. According to the Ministry of Education, even before the conflict erupted in December 2013, less than half of South Sudanese school-aged children were enrolled in school, and it's only gotten worse since then. The Education Ministry and UNICEF estimate that about 1,200 schools in the most conflict-affected states of Jonglei, Upper Nile, and Unity have closed, disrupting the learning and future education prospects of more than 400 children and adolescents. But Ambassador Twining believes the new initiative will make a big difference. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Ruakarinj in Juba.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next is our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, John Dryden, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States and the African Union are strong international partners, working together to strengthen democratic institutions, promote peace and stability, support sustainable economic development, and improve the lives and health of all Africans. Our relationship with the AU is based on historical ties and a shared culture, the necessity for increasing coordination due to globalization, and a deep appreciation of the strategic significance of the African continent. At a recent AU summit meeting in Addis Ababa, the group's leaders selected President Robert Mugabe, the longtime and controversial leader of Zimbabwe, as the group's chairman to serve a one-year term. A hero of the African independence movement for helping lead his nation to statehood in 1980, in ruling his party since then, he is also seen as responsible for serious human rights abuses, failed economic policies, and state-sponsored violence following disputed elections in 2002 and 2008. Because of these concerns, the United States imposed targeted sanctions that limit travel to the United States and U.S.-related financial transactions for President Mugabe and other individuals and entities which have undermined democratic processes and institutions in Zimbabwe. These sanctions remain in place. The United States respects the African Union's essential role on the continent and on issues of global concern. Decisions on AU leadership are decisions for the African members. The U.S. has a strong track record working with the AU, confronting the Ebola crisis, providing training and logistical support for AU peacekeeping missions, and many other issues. And we will continue that cooperation.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at voanews.com/editorials.
Hello, I'm Linor Moudou. Please join me live every Tuesday at 17:30 UTC in VOA's health program, Health Chat. Hear from doctors, nurses, international experts discussing the health issues of your concern. Health Chat puts listeners directly in touch with medical professionals. You can talk to them live for free or email your questions. Health Chat brings the medical professionals to your home.
This is a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
How much do you know about HIV, the virus that causes AIDS? Do you know that you cannot get HIV from toilet seat or a drinking glass? HIV is transmitted through blood and bodily fluids. primarily through sexual contact. One way to protect yourself if you are sexually active is to be sure to use a condom. Condoms can reduce the risk of getting or transmitting HIV by up to 98%.
That was a message in the public interest.